Welcome to Soundwalker. This is your host, David Rothenberg. This is episode 16. I'm speaking to Hugh Raffles, author of The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. It's a wandering, exploratory, extrapolating nonfiction book about rocks, stones, personal history, life, the world. Just the kind of book you cannot classify, just the kind of book I really love. I first met Hugh Raffles, who is an anthropology professor at the New School in New York. I first met him as part of this mysterious art project, This Situation, by the internationally known artist Tino Segal. What Tino Segal does is set up situations, calls people up that he decides should get together and act, but play themselves, speak, learn lines, have conversations, and he exhibits this as various works of art. Ours went on in the Marion Goodman Gallery, and we had to learn these lines from the history. We had to learn these lines from the history of situationism, take the poses of various famous artworks, and just talk to one another. At the time, Raffles had just published his previous book, Insectopedia, all about bugs, culture, history, just as this book is about stones, that was about bugs. He already mentioned back then, and that was maybe 10, 11 years ago, that he was working on a book about stone, about earth, rock, geology. And this is a deep, carefully written book. It's taken all this time, more than a decade, to write. And as you read it, it shows. You read this book, you can tell a lot of time has gone into it. I was lucky to come across the book in a bookstore, one of the first I'd been to in months. There it was. Hugh Raffles' book was out. I wanted to read it. I wanted to talk to him about it.
So I was so happy to discover your book, which I honestly did discover in a bookstore on Columbus Avenue that was strangely open, a new bookstore near the Museum of Natural History, perhaps a branch of the Strand or something like that, but it wasn't there. I went into this bookstore, like I hadn't been in a bookstore in months because the one in Cold Spring is closed, other ones are closed. And so, you know, you look and say, oh, this book, I think you told me you were working on it years ago. Like it's been around, like, and so this is it, look at it. It looks like stone, it's printed a whole weird way. And like, oh, I've got to get this. Then I started looking at it and like, wait a minute, I've been to all these places. Why did he go to these places? How can that trajectory be so parallel of all the possibilities? Like it really surprised me. And so what interests me, you know, about both of your books, the two, I don't think I've read the first one, but the other two is what are these books? Is this anthropology? Is this literature? Is it, you know, does it matter? Like,
it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Did you?
It doesn't matter to me. I mean, honestly, I mean, so long, you know, I mean, they can be anthropology. It's interesting to be in that conversation with anthropologists and to hear what they think of them. I like that. And I guess they're anthropology because they're based on fieldwork or they have fieldwork in them. But, you know, I like ethnography. I like talking to people, thinking about that, figuring out ways to write about that. I enjoy that. And I like being in conversations with other people who do that as well. So to me, that's interesting. But whether they then, you know, it's anthropology if it's recognized by anthropologists, I think. Mm-hmm. And I have a job in an anthropology department, so almost...
So do they applaud this work you're doing, or say like you're on the edges? You have to.
No, I think they're very. You know, anthropology is interesting because it went through this whole literary turn a long time ago, you know, like 20, 30 years ago now. So since then, people have just been very interested in writing and expression and representation. So, you know, I think people are open to experiment probably more than they are in other disciplines. I like to think it's a pretty open-minded discipline that goes through all these changes all the time. So it's been, you know, I think my work's been, I would say, generously received, yeah, within anthropology, yeah.
Yeah, that's when I first learned about anthropology. You know, I was an undergrad at Harvard in the early 80s, and this is what was all most interesting about it. I mostly took anthropology classes that were that had these unusual ethnographies that seemed like literature.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, I felt then there was quite a lot of tension between these you know, these people studying anthropology and these books which were sometimes read. But I remember one at TA I think it was like Civilization of the South American Indian. David Mabry Lewis was teaching the class. This guy, Dan Rosenberg, he was the TA in our small section out of 100 people in the class. He told the class, you know, I think anthropologists are the least likely people to be changed by an encounter with a foreign culture. Because I guess he thought that you're trained so much, like what you're supposed to do, what you're supposed to know, how you're supposed to react, that it doesn't get to you. But you know that can't be true.
No, I don't think that's true. I don't think it's true at all. I like the idea, but no. I mean, I think you know maybe in some ways it's interesting though, because I think anthropologists are often looking to be changed. You know, so maybe that actually does get in the way of any sort of encounter, any. I don't know. You know, also we're extremely skeptical by nature. So very skeptical of all these ideas of like authentic experience and that sort of thing. So that probably makes it harder too.
Do you feel you had authentic experiences in the writing of this book?
No, I don't think I even know what an authentic experience is. I mean, what happened a few times in that book were moments of being really destabilized or something like that, or thrown off balance. And those are, you know, I like those moments. I mean, I don't go looking for them, but I guess I like them afterwards more than at the time. But there were a few moments like that because I was in environments that I hadn't expected to be. So there's a couple of stories I tell in the book. There's one in Iceland where I actually get very freaked out on this beach at a sort of like, you know, it just started to feel very threatening and very, very sort of like horror movie-ish.
Yeah, I remember that a bit. Do you want to tell more of that story? Like just
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So actually, the way I tell that story, I tell it as if I was on my own, but I wasn't on my own. And that's a complicated story, how it comes to be that I'm on my own in the book. But anyway, you know, there were two of us. But I picked up a stone on the beach, which is something many, many people do. It was quite a large stone. And the beach was isolated. It was dark. It was winter. It was January in Iceland. So the days are very, very short. You know, 4 o'clock probably, things start getting dark, and it gets dark quite quickly. And the place we were is a little isolated. I mean, as in there was nobody around for, I don't know, 15, 20 miles probably, something like that. Although actually I'm not really sure, but a ways anyway. And picked up the stone, like quite a large stone, brought it back to the vehicle, the rental car. And when we got back to the car, ready to leave after being on this beach, the car wouldn't start. And in fact, what happened was the alarm went off instead. And so just a little confused by that, you know, like checked all the doors, all that sort of thing. And then tried to drive off, but the alarm just got louder and louder. And it became, you know, like pretty much intolerable. So I think both me and both of us, I think we sort of knew that this was something to do, because the only thing that had changed really was that we brought this, you know, brought this stone into this rock really into the vehicle. So I took the stone out of the vehicle and put it down beside the road and then got back in the car, and the car was fine and just drove off. So, you know, it was a little unnerving, but, you know, also not necessarily in a bad way, just a little unnerving. And we went to, there's a volcano museum in a town called Stikishono, which is not far. It's on the, this is in the Sneffels Peninsula. Yeah. Sneffelsnest, okay, in Peninsula. And we went to the volcano museum, which is, and ran into the volcanologist who set it up. He's a well-known internationally reputable volcanologist, a very serious guy. He was in there, so I asked him about it, and he said, no, it would be, I said, oh, because, you know, the rocks around there are, they have a lot of magnetism in them, they have magnetite in them, and, you know, there's a whole history of wrecks, shipwrecks on that coastline. And he said that it was absolutely impossible that a rock of that size would have interfered with the car's, you know, electrical systems, so he wouldn't put it down to that. But the way to test it was to take it back, was to go back there in the same car with the same rock to exactly the same place. You know, he had a whole, like, scientific methodology for how we would replicate the experiment. which actually wasn't possible. But we did go back to the place and went back just really because, you know what it's like? These places sort of like lure you back, really. They sort of call you back, I feel. Actually, I feel like rocks do that too, but places certainly do. And we went back a few days later, as I remember it, and went back down to the beach, and it's a black basalt beach, really a sort of like a, from lava from nearby volcanoes that have like washed out there. And so the stones are very much, a lot of the stones are very ground down and very smooth. But the beach was just, for some reason, it was terrifying. I don't really know how to explain it. It was just really terrifying. And we both, we went in opposite directions, then we met and we were both sort of, independently terrified. And we just sort of like ran out of there.
And it wasn't as terrifying the first time you were there.
No, it's just a sort of like, visiting the beach and how beautiful it was and everything. I think so, it's conditioned by the, by the experience for sure, And I kind of feel like it's impossible in that, to then separate out all the imagery that you have and all the, everything that you know about terrifying places and, this very, very dark looking place with these sort of fierce and jagged rocks and all this sort of stuff. But the experience was very similar for both of us at the same time. So I spent some time thinking about that, just trying to sort of understand that. I spent some time trying to understand the history of the place, trying to make sense of it. But of course, there is no sense to be made of it, really. I think if that experience is not like you can explain it out by, investigating the history or something. It's a sort of haunting, but it doesn't mean that the place is. It sort of just means that you are when you're there at that moment, I think. I don't really have a good way to explain those things.
Do you think it matters about the history of people in these places and how they relate to the land? That if you're somewhere where there's a lot of belief about the powers of stones and beaches and earth, and you hear these stories, that it could influence your own actual experience before you start thinking about it?
I think so. If you're in a whole set of conversations with people, then for sure it does. And I had been in conversations with people about objects and about the sort of like, the animatedness of the landscape and that sort of thing. But maybe what it does, I think, is just sort of like call on a part of you that is always there, this sort of like uncertainty and ambivalence that I think many of us have about, things beyond our rational knowledge, like our suspicion that there are these things and our sort of intuition that there is a whole, way of life and way of being and levels of existence or forms of existence beyond our everyday, our everyday apprehension. So there's just like these moments, in those circumstances, you might be more open to that and more ready for that. But I think it's present. I mean, we're in some ways always ready and always primed for that, so we're liable to interpret things that feel dissonant or disconnected in those sort of ways, I think. I don't think something wrong with that. I just think, different moments and circumstances lend themselves to kind of openness to that more than others.
Did you always know how these different places you went were going to connect in this book? Or did you just say, I'm on the quest for these rocks and stones and I've got to find, wherever I go, the trajectory will form, and you knew it connected to things in your family history? Or did it kind of evolve, or did you have a checklist, must go here, must go here, must go here?
A little bit of both, I think. I mean, there are places that I really wanted to go, and the book turned into this book about northern places, and I hadn't expected that. And I had ideas that I would go to this place because of this thing, a particular thing. So there's a chapter about Greenland and about meteorites in Greenland, but that was really, in a way, it's more of a chapter about New York and about the Museum of Natural History and, the history of sort of like capturing these objects and bringing them back. But I went to that place specifically because of those things. But then when I was there, of course, it's, being an anthropologist, I'm finding all these things that I don't expect. And that's part of the sort of openness of that, or what you hope to be an openness of that. So even though I had a pretty strong idea of what it was that I was looking for, it actually turned out to be really different than what I'd expected, and the story turned out to be really different. And I think that's part of what you learn to do in fieldwork, hopefully, is be ready for that. And just to be ready for that, and then figure out ways of, I suppose, pivoting in your writing or your thinking to whatever might emerge in those sort of encounters. But other places, like there's a chapter about Svalbard, and I really had no idea what I was going to do or find there, even if I would be able to write a book chapter about it. And the problem with this method is it takes a really long time to write a chapter and then a really long time to write a book. So each of those chapters took me about a year, because a large part of the process was trying to figure out what the chapter is going to be about. It's like there's all these interesting things to write about, but how they would actually, you know, form or congeal into narrative as often came quite late, you know, and after a lot of wrong turns.
And was your editor like impatient? Like, where is this book? You've been working on it for years. You're changing it into something. I don't know what it is. Did they ever say things like that? Or,
yeah, I mean, I was lucky. I had a very understanding and hands-off editor, Dan Frank at Pantheon, who, you know, was extremely generous and willing to let me go my own way. And, you know, when I'd get very self-conscious about how long it was taking, he would say to me, well, you know, it's better for me because it will be a better book if you take longer about it and it becomes more of the book you want to be. You know, you can't really wish for more than that from an editor. Probably also because they knew that, you know, this wasn't going to be a bestseller anyway, so it wasn't like their, you know, their quarterly returns were hanging on it or something. So,
but they believed in you. They said, whatever this guy is up to, like, we want to see where he goes, which is nice to have.
Very, very nice. Yeah, I feel very lucky to have worked with them. They were like that about Insectopedia as well. Mm-hmm. And also very, I mean, with this book, though, I mean, the editorial process is a little different than it was in Insectopedia. In Insectopedia, they were actually completely hands-off in the sense of they were just really happy with the manuscript. With this one, there was much more conversation and discussion about what it would be. It looked very different, actually, the first time I presented the manuscript, and then I ended up cutting about 25% of it. It had a really, really long chapter about Theresienstadt right in the middle. Mm-hmm. And that ends up as being about, you know, 20 pages at the end or something, probably only like 10 pages. And I think the book is probably better for that. Though I would like to find somewhere to, you know, all that work which went into that. It'd be nice to be able to use it maybe in another book, but at least maybe. Yeah, so, but it's interesting. I feel like, I don't know how you feel, but I like to be in those kinds of conversations and feel pushed to go back and try to rework something, you know. You know, I've been lucky, but I just feel like I've been lucky. I mean, I've watched plenty of people who've struggled in that way. And you're still working within that industry with the publicists, right, and the marketing people and all that, and mm-hmm. having to try to find a way to like align what you're trying to do with what they're trying to do. Sometimes there just is not a fit at all, you know.
Immediately when I picked up your book in the bookstore, what was really a surprise is, hey, I've been to all these places, almost all of them. How did he pick these places? The first place I ever went in Europe was Sneffels Ness, because I was writing for Let's Go Europe, go write about Iceland, go write about Scandinavia. That's the first stop. Went to Reykjavik, got on a bus, I went there. It was enshrouded in fog. What is this place? It was super expensive. It was like 1983 or something. What am I doing here? and then I live in Washington Heights sometimes, so I know about these caves and the rocks and the mysterious Marble Hill being in Manhattan. That's the stop if you want to go between Cold Spring and mm-hmm. Washington Heights.
Okay.
I was really happy to learn about this the fake Indian, you know, in that chapter. That was great, you know, the character living as an Indian.
Tragic story.
Yeah, tragic. I know nothing about that. Yeah.
No, that's such a hidden history. I got very obsessed with that, actually. Yeah, very obsessed with that whole thing. Actually, I just got very obsessed with the whole native stories in New York and just their invisibility. Became like such a preoccupation. That was another reason that chapter took a long time, because I had to sort of reorient it to all that stuff because you know, one of the great things about spending a long time over a book is that you learn so much, but also you, in the process, at least for me, I discover all these things that I really don't know that change the way I think about the world, you know. And I feel like that's partly a product of spending so long over something, and then, you know, you have the material has a chance to work on you in that way. When I first wrote that chapter, which was because a couple of friends of mine wanted to walk the length of Broadway. They were very, you know, they're like, you know, not professional walkers, but they're sort of like psychogeographers, and they wanted
like,
to...
Like, is Baptiste one of those people?
Oh, you know Baptiste, of course. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so with Baptiste, it was with Baptiste and Pascal Manery. Mm-hmm. And we walked from Sleepy Hollow. I mean, you know, there's this whole question about where Broadway starts. Mm-hmm. We walked from Sleepy Hollow down to the foot of Broadway. And then I quickly wrote something based on that for him that actually never came out, which was about...
The book never came out, that's right.
Yeah. So it was based on that. And that was going to be it was going to be in there. And I wrote very, very quickly, which is unusual for me, you know. But... And it was about Marble Hill, because honestly, that seemed the most interesting. But on the whole walk, that was like the most interesting part. Once we got into Manhattan, I was a lot more comfortable, to be honest. But arriving, that part of it I didn't know well. And so I wrote that part of it. And then when I went back to revise it, I realized that there was this whole sort of like revisionist history by mostly young historians of early America about you know, the sort of early encounters between settlers and natives in North America and in this region that really, really changed the whole way that people were thinking about this. So it took a long time to then get back into that literature, find that out, you know, and that actually came from going to an event actually at NYU organized by Lenape activists, which had some of these scholars were there and some activists were there and some representatives from the communities were there. And just the whole way that they were talking about this period was so different from the way that I've been talking about it, that it really made me want to think about it and go back and read about it, you know. That took a long time because of that. But it's interesting, right? I mean, it's important that you, I think, to go through that. So.
Yeah, all the places in your book that I've been, there's so many weird connections. Like I've been to Barentsburg. I was on a ship full of artists called the Arctic Circle, an Arctic Artist Residency, and we went there.
Yeah, I know somebody else who was on that.
Yeah, I was on, I think, the very first one, 2009. Okay. And then, you know, we had a very interesting time there. There was one artist on the ship was Russian, and she made all these connections, made a few phone calls. An entire feast was set up for us. Like just nice. A few calls to the right people, all this stuff happens, and there we were in this weird town. I've been to the Callanish Stones.
Have you? Okay.
You know, I've seen the Old Man of Hoy. I've been to Orkney, and then when I was in college,
why didn't you write this book?
Maybe I still am writing it. And then, you know, either when I was in college or right after college, I saw like this whole strange entourage walking across the campus. Like these guys, they look like Eskimos. And this guy, you know, it was Alan Counter and the two children of Peary and Henson walking around Harvard Yard. And then I read that story and then followed it over the years. And then later when I became a fellow of the Explorers Club, I learned all the stuff about Henson and this whole tale. And here you're revisiting it. You're going back. And then let's see, where else did you go? The Marble Hill story we dealt with, Callanish. You have
Tell me about Alan Counter. Did you ever meet
him? What was the year those people were there, guys? It was a little bit after I was in college, right? It was maybe 87, 88 or something.
So I was there.
Then I was, it's probably when I was working at Harvard Law School on this human rights project before I went to grad school at Boston University in philosophy. So I was living around there and I saw this whole thing. And then I learned about the story. I read about it. It was in the news. And, you know, I loved that tale because, you know, You always knew that this black guy was the first guy to the North Pole. Like that was it around. Like, okay, now someone's really going into this. And yes, there's all the stories. Everybody sleeps with the native women. And of course, they were these kids there. Like, what a great idea. Bring them to America. Like, but then as the story kept going around, you began to realize that Counter was just into this. He really wanted to push this story, as you talk about. And I heard him speak about it at least once.
Did you?
And yeah. You know, you could, and what I remember most back from the book and from the, maybe it was a TV show or radio show about it, was two things I remember. One was that Henson's family was a lot more excited to learn about this long-lost relative than Peary's, as you talk about. And secondly, there's one line that, you know, Henson's son said when he was flying, when he came to America, to the United States. What really impressed him was the roads. Look at these roads they have here. Perhaps they've been here since the beginning of time. And when, and that related to my PhD thesis, which is about technology and nature, which is called, got published as a book called Hands End, Technology and the Limits of Nature. And although literally we know the roads are recent, they haven't been here since the beginning of time, we live with them as if they've always been there. Like we take it all for granted, you know, that the road comes first. The idea of paths and wilderness, this is like an idea for us, but roads we take for granted, you know. People take it for granted when they don't want to pay taxes to fix them. They're just there, you know. And somehow at the time I thought that this idea from this Inuit guy coming down and seeing the roads have been here since the beginning of time, that really made an impression on me. And I don't know where that was quoted or if I made it up, but I think it was quoted somewhere. Did you come across that line?
Yeah. I don't think so. I don't remember that. I mean, you know, people remember Count Alan Counter very, very fondly in Kanak and other places up there. I think particularly the descendants of Peary and Henson, people speak about him very, very well. Although I think some people I talked to thought the project of going back to the US was great because they got to go to the US. But I think in other ways, I think they thought it was, they were sort of ambivalent about it, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole history is really interesting. I mean, people have strong feelings about it, but there are things that are just way more important to them these days than that. You know, I think what was interesting for people who came from Kanak was, you know, I mean, Counter is an incredible person in many ways. I mean, complicated, but amazing that what he managed to achieve for Matt Henson and also for people who came. You know, I mean, Henson, he got he got him posthumously moved, and him and his wife moved to Arlington Cemetery. He got them obviously posthumously. He got him all these medals, and I don't think he got a Medal of Freedom, but he got like pretty much, you know, a lot else that was going. He got him a rank in the U.S. Navy. All this stuff. I mean, Marion Barry gave you know, a day dedicated to him in Washington D.C. when he was mayor of D.C. You know, all this stuff that Henson just by force of personality managed to get for him, and I think people really, really, really liked that. But then there was this weird disjunction between, like you said, between the Peary family and the Henson family, because the Peary family, you know, were really, really uncomfortable with this history of having another family. You know, in Greenland, it was, I guess, less complicated for Henson, but it's still all those stories are also very murky. You know,
very murky. Really, yes, and I'm sure you've gone to see the sled. Have you gone to see the sled? You know, in the Explorers Club.
I spent some time in the archives at the Explorers Club. They're great because they have fantastic archives.
Of course, now it's mostly closed. But you should talk about this book if you want to do something with them. Either in person or online, you know. I'm always in touch with them. It's much more fun in person, of course. But now they're doing all these online things.
Yeah, they were very, very helpful in their archives. Yeah.
Have you seen the artwork, the giant artwork that was in the Venice Biennale about Henson? Probably the best thing. It was the best thing I would say that I saw that the one year I went, which was 2014.
The video of
it's not just a video. It was a whole giant room with so many things. It was a giant thing made out of plastic that looked like ice, with this visage of Henson, and there were videos and artworks. It was a total Gesamtkunstwerk. That was like the best thing. Like everybody would say,
I do remember that.
Yeah. I can't remember the artist's name, but he's around and he's back. He's done some recent things. He's from one Caribbean nation. I can't remember.
Yeah, I do remember that well. I was particularly struck by the video, which has him standing. I don't remember if he's actually standing at the North Pole, but it was time lapse, right? And you watch the sun going around. Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I think Counter helped recognize that this guy, you know, this explorer is an important part of the history of exploration, and he better be noticed and remembered. Like,
yeah, I think so. I think it's a complicated story about what's happened to museums and the history of museums as well. You know, it's interesting that I spent quite a lot of time in the archives at AMNH as well. And there's all these letters from Henson to, you know, to various directors and officials of the museums asking for employment. And, you know, they offer him, or they try to get it. He actually volunteers. He says, you know, could you, let me try and remember how these letters went. But basically the upshot was that, you know, he had the options that he was offered were as a chauffeur, as a, you know, looking after the dogs outside the museum. All these very, very menial jobs, you know.
Yeah, that was, I found one of the most moving parts of your book, the outrageous stories that he was, you know.
I think it was particularly because of the contrast with the way that Peary was treated at the time.
Of course, he was this big hero, the North Pole. It was like going to the moon, you know, and you wonder if Peary did enough to recognize Henson's achievements, but then also in that time it was assumed you had your servants, your people with you, your the leader got all the attention, like so much.
Yeah, I think Peary actively tried to take, you know, Henson out of that story, really. Although they were both so invested with having got to the North Pole, even though I think they both knew that they didn't get there.
That adds even more to it.
And both of them actually really wrote out the role of you know, their Inuit guides.
Of course, yeah. That's again.
So there are all these layers for sure.
So did in the course of the many years of writing this book, it got you closer to stones and rocks and the matter of the world, but did it get you closer to people around the world in different places that you didn't imagine would happen?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I like writing books where I get to spend time with people who have real expertise in something. Mm-hmm. You know, so one of the things that was interesting about this was, you know, seeking out and finding people who'd really spent time with rocks and stones and had close relationships with them of one kind or another. You know, people tend to be quite philosophical about it, you know, as you would imagine, because, you know, rocks almost instantly call up questions of time, particularly matter, history, but really, you know, like about deep time and the impossibility of reckoning with that and, you know, like the psychic challenge of that. So there was a lot of very interesting conversations around that, which is where all the stuff about, well, that some of the personal stuff comes into that as well, just trying to understand what happens, just trying to, trying to figure out some ways of thinking about and writing about time. I mean, hardly original, right? But at least trying to see if doing it through thinking about rocks and stones provided another way of thinking about it. You know, one of the things about all the stories, and not all of them, but most of the stories in the book are really tied to these sort of, you know, large social events. Like, I don't know, you know, slavery, the Holocaust, you know, large scale, I mean, you know, like really large scale events of sort of like social death and social loss. And so I think a lot of what I was trying to figure out in the book was the connections between sort of individual and personal loss and then loss on these kinds of scales and the way that even the hugest sort of like world historical events of that type are also composed of personal, you know, like personal experiences. And then I guess the other piece of that is the ways that those all fit into these or sort of fit along, sort of like adjacent to these, like, you know, unfathomable histories of cycling and transformation, which stones are part of and we're part of, you know, through our sort of like kinship with minerals and stones as well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it was trying to sort of wrestle with all that. And so, you know, when you asked me earlier about finding these stories in these places, a lot of that was trying to find was because there were things there which sort of like opened up a way of thinking about that group of questions or problems. That was often what it was for me, I think, or sort of like what the struggle with this book was.
Do you ever have the feeling, you know, I guess it's a kind of feeling of the sublime that I imagine people have who study vast times and processes. Like when I talk to, you know, at NJIT where I'm teaching, they have all these solar astronomers who are studying the sun, this giant observatory that's in California that somehow NJIT took over from Caltech, got all the professors, so they commute to California from New Jersey. But they're studying things of very long-term time like the rise and fall of suns, you know, not even planets. So, and then when people talk about the immediacy of, you know, climate change, just upsetting a planet, they're saying like, no, it's just a planet, you know. We look at suns, you know, the scale is so vast. The scale of rocks is so vast, and we have people and their little problems, and these rocks are, you know, evolving at such a different pace. Did that ever make you feel tiny in the middle?
I went through this period when I was writing this book, yeah. Which I'm glad I came out of, but I went through this period when people and their problems of all kinds seemed so irrelevant in these vast scales. And that started to make me feel very weird about myself. So I really had to try to reassess that. You know, I kind of really sort of, really as in those, you know, those experiences, personal experiences, human experiences really didn't matter to me for a while, you know? You know, these political questions and short-term immediate questions. And so I think some of that was trying to come to terms with, you know, like making sense of personal loss as well. Some of it was that, I think. But also, then I started to think harder or think more about just this relationship between the different temporal scales and how, you know, that just because things happen on these vast scales doesn't mean that small scales aren't also not just incredibly meaningful, but also, you know, also can be devastating personally for people. And trying to hold those two things in, you know, at the same time, simultaneously, is I think, you know, key to being able to work on these large scales. And I think it also, you know, like many things, this is also intuitive. You know, I think people intuitively have this sense of, you know, things happen immediately, but we're also, at some level, all of us are part of, you know, part of these much, much larger processes, you know, that are tied to nature and tied to just, you know, like our personal histories or, you know, personal genealogies and what have you, you know. So some of it is trying to find a way into, you know, some of the book, I think, for me, was trying to find a way into that and hold these different things in tension at the same time, or like present at the same time. It's part of the struggle, I guess.
Did you feel at different times different thoughts about how personal to make the book, how much to bring your own life into it? Or did you know from the beginning that this was going to connect to your own family histories and tragedies?
I'm not, you know, it doesn't seem like it, but I don't particularly like talking about myself and personal things. And so some people have been very disappointed in the book because they thought it was going to be really memoirish, and they thought, like, you know, that it's really not adequate to like open this up and then, you know, like not tell people all these things and not write. And that was, you know, one of the early comments I got about it. But all these people need to be filled in. They need to be much more developed. We need to know much more about how you feel about it and this sort of thing. But I really wasn't interested in doing that. More, I wanted to make those events visible so that they, in a way, stood in for other people's experiences. Because one of the things that I learned when when my family went through some difficulties was the number of people who've been through similar things. I mean, it was really, really kind of astonishing to me, like people who I knew who would then tell me about, you know, their family experiences or personal experiences of, you know, like premature deaths in this family or in their family, or siblings or children who had, you know, who had died in unexpected circumstances and this sort of thing. So in a way, it was just sort of like to mark that as a common experience.
When you were working on it, did you read other similar kinds of books, or did you try to avoid them?
No, I don't do that. Do you do that?
I'm a kind of a mad reader. I read too much. I should be more into my own stuff, I think. I read too many books.
I pretty much read fiction.
Me too, but
Was
there any fiction that influenced you in this?
So much.
In this project, anything come to mind?
So much. I mean, there are people who I go back to over and over. I mean, like someone like Jamaica Kincaid. Mm-hmm. I love her writing. And Roberto Bolaño. And Sebald.
Sebald is good.
Maybe too much. But, you know, also, you know, like I was, and it shows a little bit, but I was reading Laszlo Krasznahorkai in this, you know, like all these really, really long sentences. And so, but you know, Yeah, but yeah, I find his book very interesting, but I find it also find it impossible to get through an entire book.
That's
but
how
you know, it's like yeah. it's like good for a while. It's like exhilarating, yeah. and then it's just like then I just like yeah. have to move on.
For you, I really admire you. Really, said I'm doing this to kind of focus on this. You go deep into the story, and it's kind of very gratifying to hear that each chapter might take a year. You know, do you also think that if you were like that you're writing this because you also have a job that allows you to do it rather than having to churn the stuff out like a...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I struggle with the job, but on the other hand, it gives me the freedom to do this. I mean, of course, it would be... You know, I wonder, I think sometimes I think, well, it'd be a lot quicker if I wasn't also teaching and doing university administration. But honestly, I don't know that it would be that much quicker because it just takes a long time to figure out the ideas. So... Yeah, I'm just very, very slow. But I've never met anybody, well, I suppose there are people, but I've never really talked to anybody who writes who doesn't really struggle with it, you know?
Who writes seriously, struggle.
I mean, it's all about the angst of writing and the suffering, you know?
Yeah, I remember sitting with Barry Lopez at some conference and a guy was speaking, a former forester who started writing books, and he was saying like, I love writing, it's so easy, the words just come to me. And Barry Lopez, you know, who incredibly serious on the page, everything.
Yeah.
The person was completely funny. He goes, well, you could tell that guy's not a writer.
Yeah.
Right. Because it was so easy for him. And in the last few days, some news came out about Notebooks of Douglas Adams, where he talks about how horrible it is
for writing.
You know, someone who wrote so fluidly, so easily. And
I know, these depictions of writers on TV and TV shows, you know, yeah.
In teaching, are you ever teaching people who want to write books like this, or do you make them read books in these genres in your classes, or is this like a parallel world?
A bit of both. I teach a course on writing in ethnography, more like sort of like writing for anthropologists. And in that class, we just read fiction. Mm-hmm. So, and we sort of like read it in a more sort of, you know, like pragmatic way, trying to read to see, you know, how somebody writes and what their sort of like what kind of technical choices and skills they have, you know, these kind of questions. It's interesting, right? I never thought that would be an interesting thing to do, to sort of like break down writing down like that. But it turns out to be a very worthwhile thing to do, because it doesn't, because, you know, in a way, sort of like what it does is make everybody aware of, well, both the sort of choices and capacities that you can have as a writer if you think about what you're doing as writing rather than as producing a text, you know, but like as a sort of like practice and craft of writing. But also, I think it gives people, maybe gives people more appreciation for the high levels. You know, I try to choose good books. So the tries, you know, sort of the high level of skill and ability that people have.
So what are some things you'd have them read? What stands out that they can relate to that you've assigned?
Well, all kinds of things. People read a wide range of books, some by the people who I mentioned already, but also, you know, like, it's a couple of years since I taught it, but we read, you know, I love those books by Carlo Vikanaskad, you know, those My Struggle books. I love those. And so we've read the first volume of that a couple of times. But also things like Clarice Lispector and who else? What's her name? Olga Blumenthal.
Tokarczuk.
Yeah.
Flights is good, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not so crazy about Flights, but I love this other one. The one about the woman who lives in the forest. What is it? Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I love that book. Yeah. Yeah, and I have to. I'll go back to. I think I'm going to go back and have another shot at Flights. It just annoyed me the first time I read it.
Yeah, Lispector has a lot of things relevant to this Pond project somehow about listening.
Does she?
Like I've been, you know. Yeah. I just collecting these quotations and things that seem to relate. You know, I feel, you know, this project I'm doing now, I'm trying to extract as much as possible meaning from something we know nothing about. These sounds underwater, a mixture of plants and animals, rhythms and noises. We don't know what it is, but it's obviously right there. And it just sends me in these directions. And a lot of it's changed over the past year. Like, it involves sending sounds to people, seeing what they do with them, making music and collaborations and in directions that couldn't have been predicted. And I'm not sure how to put it all together, what to even say, what kind of book, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. so interesting.
I'll send you these.
It's an interesting process, right?
Yeah, so then, I really don't know what is going on. And, you know, the next plan is write another book proposal that maybe like someone might like. But, you know, the proposal for Nightingales in Berlin wasn't about Nightingales in Berlin. It was about sound in a wider sense. And it also made the rounds for many years before anyone said they wanted to do it. So it's like, ugh. And then, you know, it's very, it doesn't seem that clear or easy. But when you're mentioning that your class was on writing and ethnography, I wonder if it wouldn't surprise me if some people looked at your book and said, this is totally far from an ethnography. He's talking about too much stuff here. He's not going to one place and studying it and immersing. He's traveling the world with this, looking for something. And it's the opposite of what they tell you to do, isn't it? Anthropology.
Yeah. I think that's changed, but yeah, that generally that would be the case. No, I got an email from somebody this morning who said that they'd read it in a reading group. And somebody had said, why is this ethnography? And somebody had said, this isn't ethnography. And somebody had said, this is perfect ethnography. So, I mean, I'm quite happy to, like, right, you know, provoke that conversation, of course, you know. But, and I honestly don't particularly care whether it is or not, except that I guess I sort of think it is because it's, you know, it's in tradition of talking to people. I don't think you have to go somewhere, but it's in tradition of talking to people, listening hard, trying to understand what they're saying, place that in a broader sort of historical and social context, and trying to locate what they're saying, you know, in that way, so you can understand it, trying to build a bigger story out of it. Bigger story, or just like trying to build a story out of it, right. I guess. It doesn't have to be a bigger story. So yeah, I think of it as ethnography, but you know, it's such a broad genre that there's people do all kinds of work. Sometimes it's just, you know, an ethnography can be just a, you know, a conversation between two people that's just like recorded almost verbatim. People also write it like that. They write it in pretty much any way you can
imagine.
What's
the best ethnography done in that form in a conversation?
Oh gosh, you know, somebody I used to work with, a guy called Dan Linger, who teaches at Santa Cruz, did some beautiful books that are like that, which were interviews with people who were, you know, second generation Brazilian, well, not just second generation, first and second generation people, Brazilians in Japan.
What was his name again? So, you said?
Dan Linger, L-I-N-G-E.
Langer, like Dan.
Linger, L-I-N-G-E-R.
Okay.
And those books, I like those books a lot. And they seem, you know, of course they're not, they're really, really carefully edited to produce these transcripts, but they seem not edited. I feel like it's not particularly reader friendly, you know.
Does that trouble you?
No, or if it did, I'd have written it differently if it did, you know. No, I want it to be challenging, I think, in that way. Mm-hmm. I like, you know, I have a lot of confidence in readers that if they're interested, they'll take the time. So that's sort of the plan, I guess. And I think there's a fit between the style and what I'm trying to say. I like to think so. Anyway, I'm not sure I'd be capable of writing it any clearer. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Also saying you don't want to write it clearer.
No, I don't.
This is the thing.
No, I'm lucky enough to be able to write it the way that I wanted to.
Yeah.
But I do think that also probably limits the readership, of course. But mm-hmm. I don't also imagine that it would have a huge readership. So from that point of view, I think that's okay. That also gives you a certain kind of freedom. But I think people do, you know, it depends. I guess it sort of depends on what people read, but people, thing is, right, you know, people who contact you tell you, they only contact you to tell you that they like it. So of course my impression is that the book is out there and everybody loves it because all the people I've heard from have told me how much they like it. But there's probably all these people out there who have read it and aren't going to contact me because they're not going to contact me to tell me that they don't like it, right? So you live in this sort of, you know, this sort of like false atmosphere of everything having gone great.
It's the opposite, also, you know, it's the opposite of online reviews where people just write to complain. This book was impossible to finish. And this author is totally self-obsessed. That's what I always get. Like, I wanted to learn about why birds sing. I just learned about this annoying person in the music he made.
Well, you know, never read your Amazon reviews. That's like, Rule 1, I think.
The best story about that is about the guy who wrote the book Carter Beats the Devil. you know, this novel, this famous novel. He decided to look up what people said about him online. He wrote about this like 15 years ago. And somebody wrote, yeah, Carter Beats the Devil, great book. I doubt this author has another book like that in him. That's the comment he read. Like, you don't want to. People are mean. People say anything.
Really, really mean. Really, really mean.
Yeah, but you kind of want. But I like finding some ways to touch people. If you, so I'm glad that people are reading and writing to you and saying.
Me too. I like that. Yeah. I like that a lot. And also, you know, it's a big deal that somebody spends the time, as you've done, to read this book from beginning to end. It's not an easy read, and it's kind of a long read. So I do feel like that. But yeah, it's been a. I don't know if you feel like this. I'm always very happy when. That's not true. I was going to say I'm always very happy when I finish a book and can move on to the next one. But that's not actually true. I usually get quite depressed after I've finished a book because I've had all this intense focus on this thing. And then when that's gone, it's very hard to know where to put that focus. But, and I think that's quite a common experience. Do you know the composer Kaija Saariaho, the Finnish composer?
Mm-hmm. I know her. I've met her a few times. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And I was having a conversation with her and she was saying that she was coming to it. It was an event that I planned. And she was saying that she deals with that by always having another project just beginning before she finishes this one. She always sequences them, and it's usually a small project that is manageable and that will see her through until some larger commission or something comes along. I thought that was very smart. I mean, extremely organized. It's not always possible to do something like that, but I was very impressed.
I get the impression like she's very organized, very, very methodical. Like she really this. She's really together. And for myself, I always feel a little lost. Like maybe I'll do this, maybe that, you know, like, okay. And I also get distracted. If somebody actually wants something from me, then, oh, you actually care. Well, I'll do it. Like, you know, a few days ago, I was looking, you know, running in my spam folder, like, oh, did I miss anything? And there was some German radio journalist. I need to talk to you. I'm making this radio program. I want your voice in it. You know, like, can you speak some things? Like, oh, how did I miss these messages? They're just like, oh, I'll do it, you know. And so I instantly dropped what I was planning to do and recorded some things about nightingales, you know, for her program, because I felt so bad I'd missed the messages, and I feel like a little bit of hope, like someone actually cares. I know this is not healthy, you know, because you know if you're going to write these obscure things, you have to be doing it the way you want to, not because the public is going to grab it.
I think I like being
distracted when someone shows some interest. I usually have the time for them.
Yeah.
I find myself, you know, easily distracting myself away from like working on my book, you know. Let's do this instead, you know. Like I'm not so disciplined, but I also eventually get something done.
I'm sort of the opposite of that.
Right.
If I have I just like cut everything out. If I'm writing at the moment, I'm not writing. Mm-hmm. At least not on a, you know, not on like a really formed project. Mm-hmm. But when I am, it's like, you know, the rest of the world pretty much stops.
I admire
which
that.
It's not very healthy. It's
you
not,
say it's
not great. No, I don't think it's healthy.
So if you're not writing, then what are you doing instead?
You mean right now?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to figure stuff out. I'm writing some small things, which I'm not convinced are going to turn into something. I'm sort of looking for. I feel like I'm looking for a large project, but I'm really wary of getting into a really large project again, and usually that's what happens to me, so I'm trying to figure out how not to do that and not feel like it's inevitable, that's just the way that I work, you know, because it's, honestly, I find it so painful and so, okay, the thought that I hate, but I, is that, you know, I'm probably just gonna, what, you know, like if I live another 20 years, I'm going to have like two more books and then I'll be done. I don't really like thinking of my life in those terms. So I'm trying to think of other kinds of scales and other sorts of projects that I can work on.
When you see rocks now, do you have a different experience of them, wherever you are? Walking Central Park, you haven't left New York in a year. I imagine you're seeing a lot of rocks. Do you?
Yeah, everywhere. Yes, I think that's fair to say. Mm-hmm. That sounds like it should be an easy question, but so the answer is yes, but how? I don't know. I mean, I suppose, you know, first of all, I'm a very, very poor geologist. I learned some geology doing this, but it tended to be, you know, the sort of like more dramatic, large-scale, sublime geology. So, I'm always struggling, you know, like when I go to the park, I'm always struggling to figure out, you know, what kind of a rock it is, what's the process that it, which I didn't really think about that before so much, but it's interesting, right? So there's that part of it, trying to think about the process and that long history. So I'm like instantly drawn into thinking about the long historical, you know, tale of this, of whatever the landscape is that I'm in, which is always interesting, but I'm very, very bad at it. So there's that. And then the other part of it is just the, you know, like the individual, you know, like the individual rock and its, and its qualities. And so, yeah, that definitely, I suppose I have a way of thinking about them now that I didn't used to have. You know, I think about them, yeah, I immediately think about them historically, I suppose. You know, I think about, you know, like where they might have been. So usually, you know, like most of the ones that I have, quite a few around this apartment, and most of them I've got some specific history that I'm aware of, you know, like they came from a particular place that was a place for something that, you know, some kind of activity or something like that. This one came from Greenland, you know, so it was part of a hammer stone that, you know, that people used to break iron off meteorites, you know. You know, so then there's that, you know, like there's the actual sort of like biography of a stone. And also, you know, just the, I guess the possible history of one when you don't know what it is, like when you just pick up a stone randomly.
Thank you, Hugh Raffles, author of The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. A journey through rocks, stones, human history, travels that you can only experience by reading. So go out there, get the book. It's published by Pantheon. Read it, and you shall see. We heard in there some short clips from the music of Kaija Saariaho with the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra from Circle Map. This is David Rothenberg, signing off from Soundwalker. See you next time.